Could it be? I thought. I almost stopped breathing as I stared at the computer screen with tears slowing streaming down my cheeks. As I read the Blue Star Prophecy, I realized then that no matter what I did or where I went, my fate was sealed. I surrendered to this knowledge. I went over to my drawer and took out the necklace I had bought so many years before. I had worn it for 14 years, never taking it off unless I absolutely had to. The only reason it was in my drawer was because the chain was broken and I did not have the money to buy another one. With tears streaming from my eyes, I took the necklace from the box. Gently I put it in my hand, closed my eyes and took a deep breath. As I exhaled, I opened my eyes and counted, 1, 2, 3, all the way to 9. Yes, 9 points on it. The Blue Star Prophecy tells of a 9-pointed blue star that would appear in the sky just before the end times as a warning for people to prepare. And this was the same necklace the aliens had led me to buy in 1989. They had said it would be important to me and to many other people in the future. The warnings they gave me were clear. One day a star will appear in the sky for all of man to see. Nothing or no one will be able to hide its presence from the world. It will be a sign to the people that the end is near and it is time to prepare. After the trip to Arizona, seeing Shiprock and finding Harold, I was amazed. Now I knew who the Hopi people were and why they had been so important to me before I knew anything about them. I understood that what I had experienced in the past as well as today was not a figment of my imagination. My role in this cosmic and global experience was significant. Nothing could have been more clear. I must begin my work, the work they asked me to do long ago, to tell others of them and to begin the gathering. Hopi Medicine Man. Time passed very slowly after my last trip to Arizona. Since returning and finding the Hopi prophecies, my emotional self had been screaming to go back to confirm what I finally realized was part of my destiny. I left Vancouver on June 18, 2004. Once I was on the plane, I knew there was no turning back. I was determined to meet whatever was waiting for me head on. I sat quietly and reflected on the past 16 years of my life. So much had changed because of my experiences with the aliens. And aught swept through me in flashes, the past, present and future rolled into one. I could no longer think on one level as the tenses of my life intermingled. More of the answers to my questions seemed closer now than ever before. Since my last trip, I kept in contact with Harold through email. I was vague in my correspondence but did tell him that my meeting him was foretold to me in 1988. I asked him if he would be interested in meeting with me if I came back to the area, and he agreed that he would. I wondered if I was meant to spend any more time with him, or if his role in my life had been fulfilled in the desert last year. If I hadn't seen the spirals in Harold's eyes, it's possible I wouldn't have had the same reaction when I saw the Hopi men. And those moments set in motion a chain of events that lead me to my truth, my destiny and some of my answers. The wheels of the plane touched the ground in Durango. My heart beat with excitement as the wait ended. I was back, back to the Four Corners area, where I felt at home. I picked up my rental car and bags before calling Harold. We agreed to meet that evening to talk. I told him where I would be camping and he said he would come by to see me later. The sun was hot and the day was perfect as I drove into Durango. When I reached the campsite, I set up my tent and waited, and waited and waited. I kept telling myself to be calm when we met, since I was feeling rather emotional. He was much later than I thought he would be. I finally saw him pull into the campsite. Jumping out of his Jeep, he seemed happy to see me, but I could feel his apprehension as well. Clearly he was unsure of my intentions. It was a slightly uncomfortable hello as we hugged each other before deciding on a place to have dinner. As we drove back into Durango, the conversation was really about nothing at all. It was the type of conversation that takes place when both parties don't really know what to say to each other. I kept telling myself to remain calm. I had to remain calm if I was to tell him my story. Oh, where and how to begin? We ordered our meals and, as we waited, I began one of the hardest conversations of my life. From the moment I opened my mouth to speak, I knew I did not have the courage to tell him about the aliens. How could I tell him a story that began 16 years ago, a story that swept into my childhood and changed my life? Instead, I opted for the easier route. I would tell the story as though it came to me through visions and dreams. I thought this would be the best plan of action considering the time constraints. As I recounted my tale, I found it difficult to hold back my emotional attachment to it. Sadly, I allowed my emotions to get the better of me. I could see my tears were making Harold uncomfortable. He began to bite his nails and looked at me blankly. He interrupted and said he often met people whom he affected in a way that made them think of life differently. It was at that moment I realized I wouldn't be able to fully express the story of my life. So, I told him everything I could without mentioning my alien encounters. Considering he didn't know me at all, I was convinced that I had blown my chance to share with him the truth as to why I wanted to talk with him, and there was nothing more to be done. We quickly ate our meals, paid the bill, and he drove me back to my campsite. After the sun went down, I walked under the stars and wondered what this trip would bring to me. The first day proved to be intense yet anticlimactic, leaving me feeling more emotional than clear. My thoughts were jagged and disjointed, keeping me awake as I tossed and turned all night. At 5 o'clock, I looked at my watch after only a wink of sleep. I woke abruptly about an hour later to the sounds of people outside my tent. I looked at the time and realized I wouldn't be getting any more sleep. My hour of rest would have to hold me until I got to my next destination, Canyon de Chelly. I was exhausted but drove out of Durango towards my next adventure. Hours later, I rolled into the campground at the top of Canyon de Chelly, grateful to be there. I was completely exhausted from lack of sleep and my evening with Harold. All I wanted was to set up my tent and sleep. I didn't see Stevenson, so I walked a few campsites over to see if the other campers knew where he was. The three people told me Stevenson had taken some hikers into the canyon and wouldn't be back for a few hours. I thanked them before going back to my site to get some rest. The day was very hot, but I finally slept. When I woke and exited my tent, Stevenson was strolling over to my campsite to say hello. He was very happy to see me and asked if I wanted to go to dinner with him. It was a nice gesture, but I had to say no, since I was still very tired. He then asked if I would like to experience a sweat lodge the next day, and I accepted. I was excited to have been asked and anticipated a wonderful experience. I didn't go far from my campsite all day and spent my time in reflection and thoughts of what if. What if this is all real? What if I am meant to be here? What if I am important to the Hopi people? What if I am crazy? I pondered the intensity of my life as I drifted off to sleep that night. The next morning, my thoughts turned to the events planned for that afternoon. I had never been to a sweat lodge and my knowledge was limited on the subject. What I did know was that it was a sacred spiritual experience. I felt that I was meant to arrive in time to have the opportunity to participate. If I had spent the day prior in Durango, I wouldn't have been in Canyon de Chelly until the afternoon of the sweat, missing it completely. I spent the early part of the day touring the canyon, absorbing the view at the overlook sites and enjoying the red rock. I found it as a calming effect as you watch its color change. I headed back to my tent to have an early light lunch before the sweat. The heat was overwhelming, so I tried to find shade under the juniper trees. Stevenson did his usual rounds of the campsites and eventually came by to chat with me. We sat together talking about what brought me back, and I shared with him, as I had with Harold, my story of what led me back to the area. He told me he thought it was good that I was doing the sweat and filled me in on what to expect. Stevenson then had to go and get things ready, so he said goodbye and left me to my attempts at staying cool in the summer sun of the desert. An hour later, everyone gathered around the fire where Stevenson was warming the rocks for the sweat lodge. The heat of the fire was overpowering as the wood sparked and the flames rose to announce themselves to the circle of waiting people. I thought that this would be a time to mentally prepare for the experience, so I sat off to the side, quietly reflecting on my purpose there. The Navajo medicine man arrived and spoke briefly to everyone before entering the lodge. We all followed, into the dense air of the lodge, finding our place around the earth pit that was filled with heated stones. My thoughts began to calm as soon as I entered. I cleared my mind as the ceremony began in order to allow the present moment to be my sole focus. As I listened to the medicine man speak, my meditation and experience began. The chanting brought me closer to my feelings than I had been in a long time. I cried, a lot, releasing some of the apprehension and fear I was holding about my journey. The tears and the ceremony cleansed me. The ceremony took place in stages, and with the completion of each step I felt calmer and clearer. It was an experience that deeply touched my soul. I felt fortunate and honored that I was able to participate in this event, and I made that note to both the medicine man and Stevenson. I also told them that I understood the ceremony had been modified for non-Navajo participants. Had it been performed for the Navajo, it would have been different. All the same, I felt the Navajo chants and sweat deeply and was grateful for the experience. The ceremony was sacred, and we were asked to keep the experience to ourselves when we left the lodge. In respect to the Navajo, I am not able to tell you in detail the events that took place. After we emerged from the lodge, we proceeded to the next stage of the ceremony, dinner. It was my first taste of mutton, a traditional meal. I loved it, to my own surprise. As we all sat together, strangers to each other, we felt like a small family. There was a connection we had that was so clear you could almost see it in the air. As the night grew dark, we lit candles and enjoyed some tea that was made from flowers one of the participants had picked a few days earlier. It was a perfect finish to the day's events. The conversation was light and playful as one by one everyone departed to their campsites to turn in for the night. My thoughts refocused on everything that had led me to the Four Corners area yet again. I still was not sure when I would be leaving to go to Hopi Land, but I knew that when my spirit told me to go, I would leave. Until that happened, I would simply go with the flow and wait. I walked in contemplation back to my campsite, settling into a good night's rest. Morning came and I decided it was the day I would travel to Hopi Land. While I was making breakfast, Stevenson came over to say hello. He asked me what my plans were for the day, and I told him that I would be leaving. He then asked me to join him for a coffee before I left. And this was an invitation I later learned was not extended to all his campers. I observed that the people he asked to have coffee with were the ones he was interested in getting to know. Often they camped at his site to learn more about their Navajo culture. Stevenson was always willing to share his knowledge with people who were genuinely interested. After I packed up, I drove to the check-in area and sat with Stevenson to chat and have a spiritual coffee, as I called it. Stevenson was quietly sitting at the small table outside. As I pulled up, he quickly went to get my coffee so we could sit and talk. Always a friendly, joking man, I enjoyed my conversations with him. However, the visit was brief as I was eager to be back on the road. I waved to Stevenson from my car, knowing, as I left, that I would probably be back to see him before I left the Southwest. I still had almost a week left on the trip. I loved the canyon so much I felt as though I was saying, see you later rather than goodbye. I drove down the road into Chinle from the canyon and felt strength in my thoughts and myself. The sweat from the day before helped me to be clearer, yet I still had many questions about my future, a future that I had attempted to turn my back on for a long time. Even as I pulled onto leading to Hopi Land, I could feel that my entire life was about to change. As I drove, I kept saying to myself, it's too late now. I'm here, I've come this far, and I have to keep going just a little further. Everything that was told and shown to me on that fateful day in 1988 was about to be confirmed. I could feel my breath getting heavy during the last stretch of road before my destination. I knew what I had to do, but I was beginning to feel fear again. My breath quickened, my eyes began to tear, and with each inch that drew me nearer to my final destination, the fear became more intense. And is it? This will hold the truth for me. My truth. Calm. Stay calm, Miriam. I told myself, You can't get emotional like you did with Harold. For the last few miles I felt the earth change. Suddenly it felt like I was going home, as though I had been away for far too long and I was stepping back into my rightful place on this planet. It was difficult for me to understand my feelings. I pulled the car into a parking spot outside the store, McGee's Indian Art, where I had bought my Hopi ring, taking a very deep breath. Now is the time, I thought. Now is the time to step into my destiny. I sat in the car for just a moment and tried to center myself before I went inside. I held my breath as I walked inside. I then saw the woman who sold me the ring the year before. No one was in the store except the two of us. It was meant to be. Hashish gives me the opportunity to talk with her. I approached the woman whose name was Jennifer. I told her that I had been in the year before to buy a Hopi ring and a couple of books from her. I began a conversation by asking what other books she would recommend that might give me a better understanding of Hopi beliefs and culture. As Jennifer led me over to the books section, I began to open up to her. I shared with her rather quickly and emotionally the events that led me back to her and Hopi land. I told her in the same manner that I had Harold and Stevenson. I explained that I had visions in 1988 in which I was told that the Four Corners area was the safe lands. I told her about how I knew the Hopi prophecies before I read them, including the Blue Star prophecy. And I told her about my Blue Star necklace and how I came to have it and about the mountain and how it was shown to me in 1988. I also shared with her the story of the creation of man as it was told to me in the 1988 abduction and how it was virtually the same as the Hopi creation story. I told her as much as I could in my limited time of a few minutes. Jennifer told me she thought maybe I should talk to one of the elders. At that moment I knew I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And that was why I had been so afraid. I had known she would direct me to the elders, without me asking. She spoke to me with such questioning in her eyes, yet, at the same time, she was calm. It was frightening. She said, "Maybe you are the one we have been waiting for. Maybe you are the White Pehana." I'm not sure about that, I thought. I knew I was somehow important to the Hopi people, however. Not only this, they were important to me as well. The aliens told me of a people who were from the last world and had been taken to this world. The Hopi were some of these people. And it was why I recognized them when I saw them the year prior. The aliens showed me a race of people who had been saved from the last world because they were the spiritual leaders and members of the past world. As we walked over to the counter, I felt a sense of relief as well as apprehension at the prospect of speaking to an elder. I had always known, even in UFO circles, that I somehow stood apart from others. I was told information in such great detail that still, to this day, it's difficult to share it fully with people. The fact that I was instructed to remember my encounter sets me apart from many physical abductees, putting me in a very small group of people. The aliens gave me specific instructions, which was part of the reason I was standing exactly where I was at that moment. There was a lot going on inside me as I stood at the counter with Jennifer. She gave me instructions on how to get to the house of the elder on one of the mesas. She drew me a small map, telling me he was not practicing his medicine anymore and no one knew why. She directed me to him because she trusted him and apparently he knew a great deal. Jennifer also told me where her house was on the mesa in case he wasn't home. She said that she would be home later so I could stop by and tell her how it went. I thanked her for talking with me and for the directions. She went on to reassure me it was okay if I just arrived at his front door, unannounced. He may even be expecting me, she said. So, with map in hand, I said goodbye to Jennifer. I walked to the car with thoughts of how I would convey what I knew to the Hopi man as well as how much I would share with him. The one thing that was very clear to me was that I must not bring up aliens. He would have to begin that conversation. If he was not the correct person to speak with, I would quickly know. In this way I would learn how much he knew about the aliens. My emotions were back in check as I rolled down the highway, on my way to the mesa and the Hopi man. My destiny, my life, was about to change and I knew it. and is fact swelled inside of me as I got closer to my destination. The road leading to the mesa took only a few minutes to negotiate. I was mindful of not being intrusive to the people in their homes. I was a complete stranger from so far away, what right did I have to be there? As I felt energy of the people, the earth and the wind, it was all somehow familiar to me, as though I already had an intimate knowledge of the area. I knew that although they may see me as a stranger, I was stepping into my long-lost family's home. Once on the mesa, I had to stop and ask a Hopi woman where the medicine man's house was. She, in turn, looked at me with a great deal of suspicion. I told her that Jennifer directed me to his home and that she had given me a map which I pulled out of my pocket and showed her. Somewhat curious as to my business with Robert Smith, the woman tried to extract information from me, to no avail. Finally, she gave me simple directions to his home. It was only a couple of houses away, so I left the car where it was and walked over. As I did, everyone I passed kept a close eye on me without saying a word. I approached the open doorway slowly and knocked gently on the frame. "Hello," I called out. "Hello, come on in," a man hollered from within. I peered around the corner to see a man getting up from his chair walking towards me. I asked if he was Robert Smith. He seemed somewhat surprised to see me. When he asked what he could do for me, I told him that Jennifer had sent me to him. He told me that he wasn't doing his medicine anymore, so he wasn't sure what he could possibly do for me. I explained that Jennifer thought he would be the right person for me to speak with. Robert at first seemed a little reluctant to speak to me, shaking his head, telling me didn't think he could possibly help me with anything I may be looking for. He offered me a seat, however, and some coffee, which I declined. I sat at the small table and began to tell my tale, again in the format of visions and dreams rather than aliens. My conversation with Robert was extremely intense. I relayed to him how, in 1988, an experience changed me to the core of my soul. I told him about my information that the Four Corners area was the safe lands. I explained my vision of Shiprock and how it became reality. I also told him about meeting Harold and the spirals in his eyes as well as those in the eyes of the Hopi men. I relayed the story of creation and how I was told about the star that would appear in the sky just before the end to warn the people to prepare and that this matched the Hopi blue star prophecy. I continued with the story of my blue star necklace, how I came to have it and what I believe it represents. I explained to him how I read the Hopi prophecies and understood them and knew something of them as well. I told him so much and was so overwhelmed and emotional that I sat and cried with him. I could hardly contain myself, but I knew he had to be the one to bring up aliens. If he didn't, he wasn't the right person to be talking with. After some time, he looked at me and just asked bluntly, "Are you talking about aliens?" "Yes," I replied. "But I had to wait for you to bring it up." "Okay, okay, now tell me the story," he said. I then began to give him the details of my alien abduction on and all the details of my alien contacts as well as what I had been told. After some time passed, an old Hopi woman came to him and he asked me to leave and come back in a while. I quickly left them alone, telling him I would come back later. I went back to my car and had something to eat and drink as I wondered what I could do to pass my time. Jennifer had told me that if Robert wasn't there, I could go to her house where her children would be home. Since it was almost time for her to be home from work, I arrived at Jennifer's home and found some family members and Jennifer's two children playing outside. Just as with everyone else on the mesa, the children were curious about me. They told me I could wait, so I sat outside with them as they played. I was in complete awe of the entire experience. The oldest girl seemed eager to talk with me. She was a bright girl with whom I felt comfortable. It was wonderful to listen to her as she told me stories about going to school and then, just as easily and quickly, spoke about Hopi beliefs. The things she spoke of were all deeply intertwined with Hopi culture. Yet she asked me what I thought about them. I didn't ask her any questions as I thought that it would have been rude. The girl, whose name was Debbie, began to speak in Hopi to her sister. Suddenly, from their foreign language, came a familiar word. They had spoken it in Hopi, but to my amazement I recognized it. I immediately knew it as one of the words the aliens had spoken to me many times in the past. Debbie continued playing in the afternoon sun, not knowing how much her words had affected me. I asked her what the word meant. She told me it meant thank you, a woman saying thank you in Hopi. I was stunned, as this word had always remained crystal clear in my mind since they used it to communicate with me in 1988. After Debbie told me what it meant, I realized that the voice I heard speaking in this language at the time I wrote it down was female. My God, I thought, how far will this take me? How much do I need to see, hear and know before I stop questioning everything, and simply believe? After sitting in the blazing sun for a short time, I got very thirsty. I asked Debbie and her sister if they wanted to go to the store with me. They eagerly said yes, and we walked over to a small shop on the mesa to purchase a drink. Once inside, I began a conversation with a Hopi man during which I felt a strong urge to turn and look around the room. What are you doing here? I heard in my mind. Standing at the counter with his head turned and looking straight at me was a Nordic blonde alien. With one glance one could tell that he was not normal looking. He stood about 6'5" and had broad shoulders. He was very athletically fit and wearing a t-shirt and blue jeans. His brilliant blue eyes seemed to swim around the room. His hair was true white and straight, falling to the middle of his neck, while his pale, almost transparent skin covered his well-defined cheekbones. What do you mean, what am I doing here? I snapped back at him through my mind. Again he asked, why are you here? He didn't take his brilliant blue eyes off me as he waited for an answer. I looked at all the Hopi in the room, Debbie, her sister, the Hopi man and the woman behind the counter. None of them paid any attention to this man with even a second glance. It was amazing to see this because he looked so strange and out of place. I told him, "Hashi, same reason you're here, I am coming home." I stared into his eyes. He then looked away to pay for his purchase. He did not respond and I felt the telepathic communication come to an end. We left the Nordic at the counter while we walked out of the store. I asked Debbie if she had ever seen the blonde man before. She skipped along and told me she hadn't. I decided not to press the subject any further as I looked back to see if he left the building behind us. I wanted to go back and talk to him, but something told me that he was already gone. I knew the moment I was sent to the mesa that my life would never be the same. Seeing the alien confirmed to me, once again, that the aliens themselves had a great deal of interest in me as well as what I did. I decided not to tell Robert about this encounter, at least not at this time. As the sun went down in the Arizona desert, Debbie walked with me on my way back to Robert's. At his doorway, Robert hollered for me to come in. He smiled wide as I walked back in and resumed my position at the table. He then asked me why I was there and I told him again that I felt it was the right time for me to be there. I told him how I woke up one day in of 2003 and knew that I had to begin my work again. As a result, I was brought to the Hopi people. I shared with him the long set of events that had led me to Hopi land and his people, from 1988 to the spirals in the eyes of the Hopi men the year prior. My intention was to eventually share everything the aliens had told me with Robert and his people. The purpose of this trip, I said, was to find out if the Hopi did indeed know what I did. Our conversation was very much one-sided. I talked and he listened. I went into detail about some things, but I knew it wasn't the time to be completely open with him about other things. Certain areas of information had to be shared with the Hopi people as a group, if they allowed me to speak with them. I felt I needed to ensure they would listen and accept what I had to say. So, I told Robert certain things to see how he would react. During our conversation, Robert would shake his head and ask how I knew all the things I was telling him. "You're too young to know all of this," he told me. "It has taken me a lifetime to know what you're telling me here today." He asked me why I hadn't gone crazy. I told him I wasn't sure.